So this is a continuation of our interview with Louise Cox for the National Trust, who's speaking with me from Wenhanna on the 4th of March 2024 now at her home in Blues Point. So thank you again for talking to us.
Pleasure.
And we've also got Lini Grushinski from the National Trust who's here to help. So last time we talked at some length about your childhood and education and early years as an architect. And before we go on and really hear about when you came back to Australia and really got going with your career as an architect, I'd like to ask you about the fact that your mother used to take you along to National Trust dues and the fact that you actually spent your very first paycheck on becoming a life member of the National Trust in something like
1963. I checked that. That's correct.
Which must be, a very unusual way of people spending their money. So that's a fantastic. For the National Trust, that's a really wonderful sort of prehistory to what the rest of your career. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Well, my mother, she must have been a member of the National Trust. And the women's group had only just started up when I was at university, and she used to go to these house openings and have a look, and she wasn't a helper or anything, but she used to go, and I used to go with her if I wasn't supposed to be at university. So that's how I became interested in all that stuff. And,
so it wasn't when you were a child, it was really when you were already enrolled in architecture.
Yeah, well, I was at school before then. I couldn't go near it when I was at school. I was supposed to be at school.
Right. Was she doing it while you were at school, but you don't remember?
I don't know. I can't remember. Oh. Maybe. I don't know when it started. I don't remember that either.
I guess we could figure out when she joined. That might be.
Yeah, anyway, she always liked those sorts of things. So. And also, I'm going to say this now, which is out of context, but She helped at the gallery. What's it called?
The art gallery?
National Trust.
The H. Urban Gallery.
Yeah, she was a helper till she was 97.
Wow.
She used to go with her friends, and they used to drive, and they used to be on duty all day, and then they'd drive home.
How lovely.
And when they stopped, she said, "What am I going to do?" I said, "Well, what you're going to do is you're going to get a taxi in there next time. And you then get him back when you want to go home." And so she did that for a whole lot of years. And then finally they gave, when Elsa Atkin was running the place, they gave her a volunteer's badge or something, whatever they
gave
you.
Or an award?
An award or whatever it was, anyway. So it was good to see that she did like doing those things.
Mm. When she used to take you to open buildings, do you remember any of the buildings that you went to see with her and
no.
What you thought of them?
They were probably eastern suburbs houses or Mossman or somewhere. I don't remember.
Mm.
But they were somewhere in the eastern suburbs.
And they wouldn't have been houses that have been recently acquired by the National Trust. They were just houses.
They were people's private houses. I mean, we had this thing was open the day I brought Charlotte back from the hospital when she was born, so that was June or July 78.
You mean this house?
This place here was open for inspection from the National Trust, so we couldn't actually come home. I forget where we went to, but...
Well, that's certainly devotion to the cause.
We both, Philip and I, liked the National Trust, and we did lots of things for them.
Ah.
And he'd been fixing up Cameron's cottage for the Rocks people, whatever they were.
Did he do that job?
One of his very early things.
Ah.
And Howard Tanner worked for him, and they did quite a lot of heritage. And the office was in there.
In where?
Next door, in the red building.
Ah. How it... Philip Cox's office. Where he worked with Howard Tanner and lots of other people. Ah. So Howard became a very prominent heritage practitioner, had his own firm going for quite a long time, but he started doing heritage with Philip before that.
Yes. Oh, yeah. I mean, Philip did stuff for the Australian government on Norfolk Island from 68 onwards. At least 68.
No. We've got some really bad noise happening there. Do you think we could stop the... That's much better. Thank you very much. Yeah. You can still hear it, but it's not.
This is not the garbage truck.
Yeah.
It's been already.
So, is there a kind of a story about how you and Philip got professionally involved? So it's one thing to be going when you're a university student and being with your mum. What's the story of how you and Philip got involved with historic heritage work professionally?
Well, he started his practice with Ian Mackay in probably 63, I suppose. I forget. And when Philip had to deal with Tocal to see the Alexander Agricultural College off at Paterson, they were doing those kinds of things. Philip was doing that sort of stuff.
That's a modernist, beautiful modernist campus now.
But the old house was there too.
Right, there is a wonderful homestead right next door, isn't it? So he had to build it in relation.
Well, that had to be related, but because we all like, I don't know, all I remember in 1966, beginning of 1966, John Morris got some of us younger architects who liked heritage together and said, will you form the junior group of the National Trust? And we thought it was wonderful, so we all said yes. And as I said before, we went off on weekends and to certain places and photographed them and talked about them and whatever. Philip's early houses and his books that he did on rude timber buildings in Australia, and all those books were all heritage stuff.
It's really interesting that a lot of the modernist architects, the best modernist architects, also have this real strong engagement with heritage. Have you noticed?
Yes, well, Philip was even stronger than Glenn Murcutts, I reckon, originally. And then anyway, and later, when they branched out into other things, they still had a bit of heritage, but then they gave that up and started doing those sports buildings and things in Canberra and Sydney and whatever.
And what about you? Let's get back to your career and what you were doing when you came back to Australia. When did you come back from England again?
The end of 65.
So
I had to get a job, so I went back to see Graham Thorpe at Peddle Thorpe and I said, can you give me another job? I want to deal with building on the site. I'm sick of drawing details in the office. So he said, I hope you're better than you were before. And I said, I hope I am too, because I was cheeky. And,
you have to be cheeky, don't you? You can't get ground down.
You're not going to get... If you lie down...
Can I say too, isn't the whole architectural education, a lot of it is based on being criticised all the time? You have to kind of be able to cope with that year after year and almost every...
Oh, shocking. We architects do it from the goodness of their heart because they're passionate about it, and they want to, whether it's heritage or whatever, they want to build something or fix something up or retain something or whatever, because they love doing it. They don't They don't do it to make any money, as you certainly don't. It's the last thing you do in architecture.
Mm-hmm.
And, we're all mad, we're all passionate. Unfortunately, we're all taught to do all-night projects because we were naughty at university. Went and played golf or something half the week, and then we had to work all the weekend to hand it in on Monday.
Architecture students are really notorious for their all-nighters, aren't they?
It's dreadful, and they're still making them do it.
Mm.
They're still teaching them capital D for design. Well, there are hardly any really good design architects in the world, let alone in Australia. And in fact, we punch above our weight in this country. We're really good, I think.
Oh.
And, if you think of the 2000 Olympics in Sydney, only one building, which was a stadium, had a foreign architect. We were all locals, and everyone did a really good job.
Mm.
And it was... In June, July 2000, we had an International Union of Architects Council meeting here, and I took them all out to the Olympic site at Homebush, and they had three buildings they had to look at in the morning, and in the afternoon they could go off with whichever kind of building they liked, and we had all the architects lined up and buses and whatever to transport them. And they suddenly realised architecture in Australia was pretty interesting. And they loved it. And it was a really good thing when they were watching the Olympics at home. They could remember I was there and I had sandwiches in the stadium for lunch and it was blowing a gale and blah, blah.
Everyone's got memories of the Olympics.
Oh, I know.
So this was only last year, that in 2023, that they came. So they were looking at the...
2000.
They came in the year that you came.
For some reason, I got caught with running the Institute's convention, or conference, or whatever it's called, in 2000, because someone else didn't want to do it or couldn't do it. So I had to be the person organising everything, as well as organising the UIA, what they did when they were here, and then some of their sports and leisure people came as well because they wanted to see the sports building. So we had a lot of architects running around in June, July. It was that weekend.
Which was about 2 months before
when the
Olympics took place.
Completely wrecked Homebush by putting in all these package air conditioning units to air-condition everything. They had these things and condensers outside every building, and they looked, I nearly had a heart attack when I saw the buildings in Olympic mode, but anyway, so what?
It was just temporary, so trying to...
And they had extra seating for the aquatic centre and everything, and there was extra seating for the main stadium too, which they took off.
Hmm.
It had to have 80,000 people or something.
And so the point you're making is here is that other Olympic sites around the world, every 4 years one gets built, tend to be more international, but this one was remarkable for being very Australian and still
the
being up to the...
designers, what I'm saying is the designers were mostly Australian.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And yet it's perfectly...
Because we're
quality.
Perfectly competent, and the trouble with Australian architecture, people overseas don't know about it.
Mm.
When they do, they get a bit of a shock.
Just like the Sydney Opera House.
Absolutely.
When you see it in person, it's so much even more spectacular than even in a photo. Mm. And the point you were making before that was that there's a huge emphasis in architectural education on design, big D design. Were you suggesting that really there should be other aspects of the architectural profession that
absolutely.
University should be?
The history of architecture is absolutely essential. And I don't even think it's taught properly anymore, if at all. Sometimes as an elective, which I think is disastrous.
Mm. And especially Australian architecture is now left out, I think.
I don't know. I have no idea, because I did it 60-something years ago.
I remembered the name of that text, Bannister.
Bannister Fletcher.
That was a text I remember. What's the key architectural text that they used at Sydney University for decades?
I've got it next door somewhere.
So what are the, can we just talk about this? So I agree, there's huge emphasis on design at, say, at Sydney University at least.
Well, all universities.
They all seem to be. Do you think internationally as well?
Yes.
Whereas there should be a lot more on a whole lot of the other skills.
First of all, you have to understand how to build a building, how to put a brick on a, if you're going to use brickwork, how to put a brick on a brick, and why you put a brick on a brick, or why do you use a slate roof with three layers? So you keep the water out and it's all got to overlap. But nobody teaches you that. We were taught, oh, look up Mackay's building construction page 12 and draw, which was a slate roof. We weren't given the principles of why you did things. I had to learn by going out on the site for years. It took me about 10 years to understand how to build. By looking at it, seeing it, watching them do it, asking them questions, until I understood what the principles. But I mean, now I've got all the computer stuff, computerised drawing and all that, whatever you call it, which I can't do. I don't ever want to know how to do it. And it's very handy. It's a tool, though. It's a wonderful tool.
But it has replaced people learning to draw, I think, for...
Yes, and it's replaced them understanding how what they're actually drawing.
How is that?
Well, I used to make the kids blow up the computer drawing, tilt to full size, and then I'd say, look, why is the brick wall coming into the building there instead of in the middle of the column? Why isn't that edge of the column lining up with that edge of a brick wall? And you can't tell when it's a small scale.
And they hadn't thought about it when they were
Because they were taught how to do computer drawings, not why you did it and where that. Okay, so you just draw a few walls and columns and stuff, and not how you build it and put it together. Most of them haven't got a hope in hell of understanding that. I'm sure it's still the same.
Or until they get into the industry and they start learning on the job. There was an eye roll then.
There's definitely an eye roll, because I wonder what the drawings were like during COVID. So one of my specialty was checking stuff. And I don't know whether you'd let the, I don't know how they check the drawings and ship them back to these people and say, fix this, and this.
So what were you, just tell us what you were doing then. When you're checking drawings, what role did you have there? Were you brought in as a teacher at the university?
No, I'm checking out drawings before they went to tender.
Oh, your own office?
Oh, God, yes. I wouldn't trust anyone in my office or anywhere else.
All right, well, let's get back to your career. So we're back to 1965. You went to Peddlethorpe, and Thorpe...
I went 66. And he gave me a job, and I think I stopped on that. It was the Australasian Pioneers Club up in York Street that they had. It was a clubhouse.
And you were allowed to control it, like to design? And
no, I just... I was dealing with the builder. I think we even had the builder by then. So I was learning how to build on the site with a guy.
I'm sure builders do a lot of teaching architects about...
They have to, and they try you out too. And the girls all complain, but the boys don't complain, but I know they're tested.
How do they test you?
Ask you terrible questions about how would you do this and how are you going to do this? And if I didn't know, I'd say, well, how would you do it? Then they'd tell me, then I'd fix up what it looked like.
You'd adjust the design, so.
Yeah, the detail.
Mm.
So it looked all right. That's how I learnt.
I'm sure they much prefer an architect who's a bit humble enough to take some
Those cocky people. It's like they hate architects mostly.
Mm.
But I have been known to walk in and push the wall over when they really annoy me on one job.
What was that? What do you mean?
They were being rude about women architects. And I was on this job of ours, and they just built a little walls to show what the brickwork was going to look like. And they'd been very rude to me at the site meeting, so I just walked past and pushed
the wall over.
And fell over because they'd only just done it. And they all looked at me, and they all, after that, they were not rude anymore. I just did it casually as I walked past, but you know, you.
Can I just take that as a tangent to ask, did you encounter many comments about women architects?
Oh, yes, all the time.
Oh. Tell us some of them, the ones that stick in your mind.
No. I mean, one of the jobs, they always took you through the men's toilet on purpose. Well, I think seeing that, being there, done that, you know, I could be rude about them if I wanted to, but I just walked through and just.
But to try to offend you or make you feel out of place.
And then if they did one job I had, the roof, they put the tin roof on it. It was appalling workmanship. And I said no, it was no good. They had to rip it all off and start again.
But was that to do with being a woman architect?
No, that was, I was an overseeing person. I'm not going to have bad workmanship on my job, thank you very much.
So do you think they're trying to get away with stuff? Because
yeah, they have. Yes.
Hmm.
Anyway, I defected the roof and said you've got to rip it off and do it again. Unfortunately, I was very pregnant at that day, and I had the baby that weekend, so someone said to the girl, oh, she said, it's just all because she's pregnant, and she said, but it wasn't at all because I was pregnant. I was furious.
And so they didn't replace the roof as instructed?
In architecture, and it was a public works job. It was a joint job between public works and the Nicholas Smith and Johnson. So we were equal. And when you did a specification for the government, you couldn't specify exactly what you wanted. You could describe it all, but you couldn't say it's colourbond roofing and it's this thick and that. Well, you can say how thick it was going to be. The builder decided that he was going to give us a cheap option, and the Department of Health thought it was wonderful, it was going to be a bit cheaper. So they said, yes, we have to accept it. And I was saying, well, why? Anyway, so I suppose my reaction to the workmanship was because I knew it was thinner and flimsier and not as good as it should be. Anyway, so they got out of that.
Because you were busy next week.
Yes. Yes.
Oh. And any other examples of that kind of where you felt like you encountered discrimination? Because especially in the 60s, 70s, I imagine even now people talk about it, but it must have been quite rife, you know.
Yes, really. Yes, it was. And when she was born, I took her on the site. And this is an aside, the clerk of works, when I went, I'd been out on the site with somebody, the poor clerk of works was in the site shed with my screaming kid, and in walked the public works person who was a site manager for public works, and he yelled at the he yelled at the poor part of the earth. I said, if you want to yell, yell at me, because it's not his fault. He's trying to do the right thing.
Trying to help you.
Yeah, and try to calm the kid.
Was that Charlotte?
Yes. And another time I was walking on the site and I tripped, because I tripped. I fell over the curb. I had Charlotte in my arms and I hit the road and the curb. And this doctor screamed at me and I said, I lifted up my arm with blood dripping down and I said, well, there's nothing wrong with the baby, what about me?
Well, thank goodness.
Yes, I know, but you know, I mean, people jump to conclusions without understanding the facts half the time.
Mm-hmm.
But there are ways of dealing with everyone. I learnt them all very fast.
Mm.
And I'd rather be on side with the builder so we can discuss whatever it is in a very rational manner so that we all agree where we're going next.
Mm.
It's pointless having a fight because they have to build it and we have to make sure it's okay.
Mm.
So I've got lots of things to tell them, and so I'm not going to take.
Okay. Why not?
But, you know, I say the same to the guys. I say, I know you're tested. You just don't ever, you're too proud to admit it.
You're tested, oh, that the builders would have put you through there.
They're always tested by the builder if they're young and innocent.
Do you remember, oh, you did give us an example of the test that the builder gave you. Were there any more? That there must have been a lot, actually.
Oh, there
probably
were a lot.
Every site.
Every situation was different.
Mm.
But if, I mean, I'm a pretty open person. If I don't know, I'm not going to say I know and pretend I know because I'll get caught out.
Mm.
So I'd rather ask them how to do it.
Mm. That's right. That was the technique. Alright, well, can you tell us what else you did at Pendlethorpe and Walker before you moved maybe to McConnell, Smith and Johnson? Like, how did that transition happen? And
Pendlethorpe, that, I can't remember. I've been trying to think of what I did before I left. I don't know what I did, but I did.
Were you there for long?
Yes, 66, beginning of 66 to June 68.
Okay.
So I've worked on the Randwick Racecourse thing that they were doing. Worked on that and I detailed all the kitchens and the bars and all those sorts of things and made them work and dealt with the kitchen equipment people and all that. So it was good to do that. I learned for the rest of my life then.
Was this an old building at Randwick Racecourse?
No, they were doing
on
a new stadium, whatever, grandstand.
Mm-hmm.
I worked on that. I did a bit of vague bit of work on the Royal Hospital for Women, but not much. Well, I did the Pioneers Club first and Randwick. I don't know, I forget.
Hmm. And then why did you decide to move over to the other firm?
Because they told me they were going to move me off the Randwick job, that I had to work with someone I didn't like at all in there, and I said, no, I'm not. So
and you're not going to name who.
So the person I was working, the director I was working with, knew some MSJ. In fact, I think he'd been in the Air Force with them. And he rang them up and said, and I got the connection that way.
Sorry, and who was that who did the connection? Someone at
one of the other directors.
So helped you?
Yeah.
That's lovely. And you didn't, by that stage, have your own ideas about where else you'd rather be working, or did you just...
No. We're lucky to have a job at all.
Mm. Mm. And especially, I think, as a woman, I think maybe some businesses...
But they say are pretty fair to women, really.
Mm. I think you said that before. They already had quite a few. Mm. And then you started with them, and are you still with them?
No, I got out in 98.
98. Oh, that's 25 years ago, but it's still a long time. It's still 30 years, and...
I had nearly 30 years then. Yeah.
Mm. Mm. Can you tell us about...
I started telling you last time, but... So I worked on the Commonwealth State Law Courts,
mm-hmm.
doing all the internal building details. And every time I find someone who's working on it in another office, I ask them a question, because one of the columns was sitting on top, about that far above the tunnel roof of the... of the city circle line.
The railway.
Yep. And we had to put it on, not acoustic, on... Well, they were acoustic things to stop the vibration of the railway getting into the building.
Mm.
So, I like those kind of things.
That was like quite an innovative sort of talent.
It was. I mean, I didn't know. The engineers had to tell me how to do it.
Mm.
We had to document it all. Mm. I didn't document the outside or the glass or any of that. No. And I did learn how to do acoustic walls in lightweight materials, which is very good. Because every time I did a hostel from then on, we did it in lightweight, and I knew exactly, I didn't have to ring up the acoustic engineer every 5 minutes and say, how do I do this? How do I do that?
Mm. And that would have been quite new technology at the time too, I suppose.
Yeah, well, it was the last steel, steel frame building in Sydney. After that, so that was 68 to about 72 or something. Then they started doing reinforced concrete framework for the buildings.
Mm.
Before that, it was all steel because it was quick. You wreck it quickly, as I said before, I had to find out how to fire rate steel. Before we encase lightweight stuff.
Why did they move to reinforced concrete from steel? Was it cheaper?
I suppose so. Well, also the opera house was happening, and that was all concrete.
Hmm.
And I think Sydney suddenly realised that concrete was a good material to use.
I suppose we had access to the materials as ready access.
I mean, Ashworth took us down when we were in third year, so that was the year I failed, 59, as I said, to the Opera House to watch them, to talk to them when they were doing all the foundation work and stuff like that.
How wonderful.
It was, so I had a very long connection with that.
Was Lipson around at that stage?
Yes.
Did you see him there?
I don't remember. Mm. I did march though in 1966 when all that letter and stuff happened and he resigned. I did march up to Parliament House. And I was there when Harry Seidler gave a speech and Michael or someone who's a photographer gave one at the gates of the site. I did go to the Institute meeting in the lower town hall. It was chaired by Ron Gilling, who was a president of the Institute at that stage. So that was interesting. So I was home in time for that from Europe, so that was good.
Exciting times. Had you joined the Institute by this stage? When you joined the National
Trust? I joined the Institute as a student, so in 1957 I would have joined the Institute as a student.
Mm.
Because We got the magazine. It was £5 to register as an architect. I don't know whether I joined. We had to pay £1 or something. I don't know. But we got the magazine and it came monthly. We thought it was wonderful.
And then did that also mean that you started meeting Institute members, even while you were, other students obviously, but also going to Institute dues?
No, I didn't really. Hang on. In 66, when John Morris asked us to deal with a junior group.
At the National Trust?
Yeah, that's when I joined the Institute's Heritage Subcommittee, or whatever it's called. It wasn't called that, I forget what it was called.
So they already had a heritage?
Yeah, we had the heritage thing started in the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
With Peter Bridges from Public Works and Orwell Phillips, mm-hmm. Peter Phillips's father.
Right.
They were all on the committee when we joined.
So that's a wonderful learning experience.
So
for you
that
too.
Was fantastic.
Mm. Did you find that to be a good way of finding out?
Yeah, well, when I had to do the Action Plan 13 stuff, in the early 70s, when I did the list, I put all the buildings that we told the council that they should put on the list, I put them all onto the Institute's 20th century list.
Mm. And
no one could stop me.
And onto the National Trust list as well? Or did the National Trust list inform
them? We had an agreement with the Institute had an agreement with the National Trust that the Institute would deal with 20th century and they would deal with 19th and 18th or whatever it was.
Ah, really?
Because that's all they wanted to know about anyway, some stupid inn that was built in 1810 or whatever it was.
I think Clive Lucas talks about sort of battling to get even Federation buildings into the National Trust Register.
It's even been a battle to... even get 20th century buildings on the New South Wales Heritage List, as you would know. People don't really like them.
Well, I don't think there's anything in principle. I just think the difficulty is getting
over consent. Yeah, exactly. It's harder because it's younger architecture.
Mm. No one objected to the Sydney Opera House going on, though.
Took four goes to get it on, though.
Well, no, that was to get onto the World Heritage List, but I think it went straight onto the State Heritage List.
Yeah, but it wasn't list. No, that was the problem.
Tell me.
It wasn't listed on the city list, and it wasn't listed on the State Heritage List.
That's right.
So it couldn't be World Heritage List until that was done, and that was awfully late because I was around when all that was happening.
Mm, 2005 we worked on
it. Yeah, well, that's ridiculous.
Mm.
It was opened in 72.
Mm. I mean, they first tried to get it on the World Heritage List in 1981.
I know, that Jim conservation
plan. And then 1993 he did the conservation plan, 1995 Jane Donicelli did the second one. And then 99 was
I know. But finally, but I had. So. I had meetings with David Tomlin, the minister, the federal minister for heritage and thing. I'd be a liberal man. And he said, I said, you've got to list the Sydney Opera House.
On the national list?
Yes. And he said, we can't. He said, you have to get it listed on the state list. And in 2000, at that UIA meeting, we had a lunch in the Opera House with council, and Andrew Refshulgi was the heritage minister at that stage, and he yelled at me because I'd put the Sydney Opera House on the International Union of Architects list.
And why didn't he like that?
Because he said, you can't, and it wasn't even listed on the state list then. And I said, Andrew, this is the UIA list is not a, it's not a statutory body. But it should be on that, it's World Heritage, it should be on the list. Oh, he didn't like me. He called me out in the middle of, in front of all my peers of the UIA Council. I got into terrible trouble. I just smiled sweetly.
Wow.
And took it, because what else can you do?
No.
No, there's been, anyway, at least it's listed now.
It was probably an important part of making him realise that it had to be done, even if he was trying to say, argue the opposite.
Whether it was Liberal or Labour, it didn't matter. No one was interested in it.
And why was that, do you think? Why were they resistant?
Oh, well, they all knew it was a good building. They just, it was hot, too hot to handle.
As always. Mm. Your house is always so hot. But why do you think?
I don't know. They probably had some other pressing community need of feeding the people or something. I don't know.
Mm. Well, we've kind of...
I mean, I was on the Heritage Council from 96 to 99 or whatever it was.
Oh, tell us about that.
Well, I was on it as the alternate from 93 to 96. We had to share this position with the Planning Institute.
So the Heritage Council because has about, what, a dozen seats, and some of them are designated for certain organisations to put a representative. So you were representing Institute of Architects, but it was only half a seat really because it was shared with
The first half I was only the alternate, so I couldn't, but I did go to all the meetings before I went to the subcommittee. Must have been what's now called a register group. A register. Anyway, a list of, I don't know, which I was on so many committees out there, I don't remember.
Mm. But what do you remember about that sitting for the Heritage Council? Did you find it an interesting forum?
I loved being on the Heritage Council. I didn't care if I was only the alternate, I was still going to make a noise.
Mm. Well, that's, you're supposed to, aren't you?
Exactly.
Was that when Hazel Hawke was the chair?
Yes.
So the former wife of the former Prime Minister?
Yes, she's terrific, actually.
I believe she was. I heard that.
She's a lovely person.
Yeah, people really loved
really
her.
Really nice. She and I sat on this wagon going through that town up the top of New South Wales. And Peter came from on this horse and cart taking us through this town.
Was that a Heritage Council kind of type visit that they set up for you?
sharing reminiscences about both our ex-husbands. It was hilarious.
I wish you could tell us, but you're not going to.
It's quite funny.
And were you involved in anything controversial with the Heritage Council? Well, it sounds like it was 6 years, like 3 years as an alternate and then another 3 years. Were there listings or development work that you remember being part of the decision making for?
Oh, well, it's just the usual, you know, you just got to get it through, can you get it? Some got through, some didn't. Some were still there when I came back. When I came back here in 2012 or something, and I, somehow, for some reason, I was out of Parramatta.
Where the Heritage Council sits?
Yeah, and Lawrence Neal was the chair at that stage. Was he the chair?
I think he was. Maybe a bit after that.
And I said, Lawrence, I'd really like to get back on New South Wales Heritage Committee. I really liked that. So he got me back so I chaired the register group for years.
Great.
Until Frank got rid of me, because he didn't like me.
Frank who?
Oh, the current chair. The man who knows nothing about heritage. He was scared to get rid of me. He did it at the end of a council meeting at the quarantine station at the Christmas dinner.
Oh. He just informed you that you wouldn't be sitting in future.
10 minutes before we had the dinner. And I knew he'd known all day at least, because they gave me a present. It was all packed. Look, I just thought, Frank, for gosh sake. I know you're scared of me, but and I do bite when I want to. Yeah. I'm a big enough girl to take it. I was lucky to last as long as I did.
What do you think? So, what do you think you were doing that he would prefer you weren't there to not do anymore?
Oh, I was pushing that we. Well, they said they were only going to list 20 buildings a year, which is ridiculous. They could have listed 40 buildings a year. All the stuff was done, but then you didn't have enough staff to deal with it. That was a problem. Some of the staff didn't understand buildings anyway, so that was another problem. So whoever it was, you know, you were lucky if you got a decent report on each building that was going up to the council to get the tick.
And so you were sort of pressuring them to redo reports?
Yeah, I gave Tim Smith a thing, a list of 130 buildings or something.
That you thought should be listed?
Well, we had them, they were on the list to be listed. Was dreadful, and that was everything that was listed. So if it was Aboriginal or engineering or social or something. Philip's got one building listed, which is Tokau. What's his name? Glenn Merger's got two. It's appalled. Half of Philip's have been pulled down already anyway, so.
The Darling Harbour.
They'll never get.
Award-winning buildings in
that Canada. Was the best building too. That should never have gone.
Which one?
The exhibition centre thing. That was really good. You look over it now, they built it so that you could look from all the buildings around it, that you could look over Darling Harbour as a landscape thing as well. That's why they were lower rise buildings. The next minute the Liberal government comes in and lets them build hotels and things and, you know, why would you have a two-storey exhibition centre? It's ridiculous. And it's bad. I mean, it's a shocking building.
And it's listed on the State Heritage Register, so the Heritage Council did try to save them, but they still turned on State Significant Development and demolished them, I believe.
Yeah, well, if the government's going to do it, they do it.
Were you, shall we go back to your career a bit more? In 2008, 1998, you finished with McConnell, Smith and Johnson. What happened after that?
I went and did lots of work for the Heritage.
So you sort of went to, you sort of retired from professional roles and became...
Well, they didn't like me anymore. I had a big fight with them.
With the constant
and they didn't pay me.
And you were a director, weren't you?
Yeah. Anyway. So I thought, I was much more interested in international politics at that stage for architecture. In 1996 I was elected to the International Union of Architects Council in Barcelona, and I was, I'd go off to the meetings and not be in the office and blah blah, and they didn't like that. They didn't like it when I was president of the chapter, they didn't like it when I was national president either.
That's incredible, you think it...
And Peter Johnson had already done it all. David Jackson was there running the law courts when I first went there, he did it all as well.
So you think they think
they
it's
were jealous? I had so many contacts; it was ridiculous. I knew everyone in the Liberal and Labor governments in the state and the national. I didn't at that stage forget things. They didn't use me. It was pure jealousy.
And do you think they didn't mind when the men did that, but they did mind when you did that? So it's kind of a weird form of sexism again.
It's all personal, isn't it? Became personal. It shouldn't have.
Well, Well, tell me why. Let's go back to that when you first became. Why did you become involved in the running of the Institutes of Architects? How did that become interesting to you?
Well, I had Sophie, and now I got bored again. I'd gone back to. I looked it up. So she was born in 81, and I went back. I must have gone back to the chapter, and I was still doing the heritage subcommittee thing, and I must have joined the practice group or something of the chapter in 84 at least, and I chaired it in 86 to 88, and I was on chapter council by then, and then. And we moved the headquarters from Miller Street next to the council chambers, opposite the council chambers.
Do you mean in North Sydney?
In North Sydney to Potts Point.
To Tuscombe.
And half the people wouldn't come. And the constituents all said, we're not coming across the bridge.
I didn't realise the institute was in North Sydney.
Oh, yeah, there's lots of things that we had to do to fix it, try to fix it. And I realised, anyway, Lawrence Neal said he was the president when we moved across. He said, why don't you be the president? And he encouraged me. And I decided, okay, why not? So I did it.
And what did it involve?
Yeah, I got my marriage complete. Too much stuff, too little kids. I had to have babysitters anyway, and because I was working and he was working.
It is incredible that you would have time with little kids.
Well, I used to let them all go to bed, and then I'd do whatever I had to do. So.
And did you have them all in childcare from
Yes.